This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to and hear about a beautiful and awe-inspiring piece of music, Verdi's Requiem, with our guest, conductor Yannick Nezet-Séguin. He leads two of the world's great music institutions, the Metropolitan Opera and the Philadelphia Orchestra. He chose to perform the Requiem for his inaugural concert as the music director in Philadelphia in 2012. The Requiem is a choral masterpiece featuring the orchestra, four solo performers, and a full choir. Our station, WHYY, streamed the performance in July, which gave Terry the chance to talk to Yannick again about his life during the pandemic and why he chose this stirring piece to begin his work in Philadelphia. Yannick is a young, charismatic conductor committed to interpreting classic works and presenting new, adventurous music. He grew up in Montreal and continues to return there to conduct. He's also been a guest conductor at orchestras around the world and was the music director of the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra. He became the third music director of the Metropolitan Opera in 2018 and became the Philadelphia Orchestra's eighth music director in 2012. We'll start with some of Yannick's first performance as music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. From Verdi's Requiem, this is the tuba mirum section of the movement called Dies Irae, which translates to the Day of Wrath.
Yannick, it is so good to see you and to speak with you again. I just want to say it's a magnificent performance of Verdi's Requiem, and it's such a really awe-inspiring piece. And it seems so fitting to hear a Requiem now when every day there's a pandemic death count. But when you conducted this, it was in 2012, and it was a celebratory performance. It was your first performance with the Philadelphia Orchestra as its music director. Why did you choose to make this your inaugural piece?
Well, Terry, as you just said, this is a piece that's very awe-inspiring, but also it's a piece that is very deep and has a lot of content which is not necessarily uplifting in a way immediately, because of course it's the mass for the dead, and as in many requiem in the history of music, in my opinion, it brings the best out of the composers who choose to write or put such a text in music. Thinking of Mozart, thinking of Brahms and Verdi, maybe those three, maybe even above all the others, or Fauré as well, Gabriel Fauré. So when we chose that piece, I remember us in Philadelphia talking, what does it mean to start a music directorship with a Mass for the Dead? So we did have to already immediately take into account all of these questions. And I remember that what really inspired me to do this was that I feel that it's important through music to always convey the power of those pieces and what they mean for each individual sitting in the concert hall, or as for now, each and everyone listening to this and watching this from home. And the meaning is that we all have to deal with death and life after death and people around us and our own, also our own relationship to living. And that in the end, to live this as a community makes us feel less lonely, makes us in a certain way hopeful. And this is why maybe it's relevant to have it now in these times. And of course, the other reason was a bit less philosophical, but it was about my love for vocal music as much as symphonic music. And I think this Requiem is just the perfect example of the balance between the two.
So I want to talk to you about a specific part of the piece, and that's the Dies Irae. It's around 10 minutes in. I don't know if you'd officially call it the second movement or not, but this is the Day of Wrath section. And I want to quote a few of the lines. "The day of wrath, that day will dissolve the world in ashes. How great will be the terror when the judge comes, who will smash everything completely. The trumpet scattering a marvelous sound through the tombs of every land will gather all before the throne." And like, my goodness. And meanwhile, what's happening musically is that this huge chorus is singing this descending line, and there's a bass drum marching in the background, and it's just chilling to hear this as all the singers are basically pleading for mercy on Judgment Day. Why, like, I find this musical passage just so, it sends chills down my spine. What is happening musically that so powerfully conveys the text?
Well, I couldn't agree more with you. This text is very powerful, but I think it's unique in the history of music to have been able to capture all these elements musically so powerfully. And that's also one of the great examples where the music is magnifying the text or amplifying it in a way. So you mentioned already the bass drum chords. Those are very unique. We do it with a large bass drum nowadays, but it has to be mentioned that Verdi was imagining that an instrument would be even built for that. He was imagining a huge bass drum, which was not available at the time, which was in wood. And one has to get the right sound, because it cannot sound too dry like a military drum, but if it's too boomy, it doesn't have the impact. So yes, it's like looking at those paintings of the Last Judgment, especially in churches in Italy. You imagine there's a constellation of people around it, but there's like the motion is coming to us. And those descending line you rightly pointed out from the chorus are actually really like the judgment descending upon us. And that is, of course, one part of it. But the chorus is most importantly, I think, representing the mob of all of us humans in fear. When it quiets down after a couple of minutes of that, into that movement, it talks about the terror, and the chorus is whispering, but all at once, "Quam tus tremor est futurus." And afterwards, there's the final trumpet, the judgment, the trumpet of the judgment, like in the Bible. It is, and that was completely revolutionary in Verdi's time. It is actually six trumpets, two on stage, but two on one side of the auditorium and two on the other side. So it is a written echo effect, imagining that the trumpets in the world will come from every part of the planet. And this is an example where, of course, the text is taken almost like literally, put it down into music, as if you listen to the same text with Fauré Requiem, which I quoted earlier, it will be in a much more, I wouldn't say detached, but symbolic way. It will be something quite loud, but not necessarily overly dramatic. And of course, those two approaches in art are equally valid, but the Verdi Requiem, this immediacy is just unlike no other.
And that descending line with the orchestra, is there something special that's happening harmonically to give the sense of anguish and pleading?
Yes.
And doom?
Yes. So, absolutely. So this is almost like a Baroque way of doing things, like what Bach would have done to create an affect, which we call this, which is an immediate emotion or an image emotionally. So those descending lines is what we call the chromatic scale. So it's every little half step of the scale. Ta-di-da-di-da-di-da-da. So that is actually the anguish, because it is almost like a huge sigh or a huge cry. It's like a giant tear that is that we hear. And the fact that this is repeated over and over again is also incredible.
Here's Yannick Nézet-Séguin conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra during his inaugural performance as music director in 2012. This is the beginning of Dies Irae from Verdi's Requiem. That was the first part of Dies Irae from Verdi's Requiem, conducted by our guest Yannick Nézet-Séguin with the Philadelphia Orchestra in 2012. We'll hear more of his conversation with Terry Gross after a break, and Ken Tucker will review the new release from singer-songwriter Mickey Guyton, one of the few African-American women recording country music hits, about it.
You know, you talked about this Requiem as being like your introduction to it when you were 15 and singing it, that it was a transition point for you from believing in music, believing in religion, to believing in music. Did you ever have the fear of eternal hell, the fear of judgment day and eternal flames that this piece, especially the Dies Irae, expresses? Did you live with that?
Interestingly, not really. Or, I'm not saying not at all, but this is not the focus of how I conceived and still conceive religion or faith. The expression of it, or maybe that's now the Yannick of 45-year-old talking to you. It's more, because it's hard maybe for me to know what I was thinking back then about this. But today I would say that unfortunately, my fear of it is more what happens on Earth.
The suffering.
Right. It's yeah, it's all the suffering. It's all the danger. It's all the unknown. It's all that we are at the mercy of always something greater than us. And the recent months have proven it, you know, that even though we try hard with technology and everything to control our destiny, there's something at some point that will be greater than us and we have to react. And don't get me wrong, I think that with all the fears and the bad, the tragic death and everything that's bad that's happened and is still happening to our world during this pandemic, there's also hopefully some good lessons from it. And I try to believe that humankind will also see a few of those wake-up calls. But for me, the judgment day in that Requiem, what it depicts for me is more the fears of the human life on our Earth, that we don't want the Earth to explode in a few decades. We want to take care of it, and I hope that maybe that's another way to understand this very quintessentially human and not necessarily religious message.
You're in Montreal as we speak, which is a lot safer than the U.S. is right now in terms of the virus. Since death is something you've thought about a lot over the years, since childhood, perhaps more than a lot of other people, I'm wondering how the presence of death right now and hearing the death numbers every day is affecting you. Because I'm sure you're not only thinking about yourself, but of people who you love in Montreal and in Philadelphia and in New York, where you conduct the Metropolitan Opera, and around the world, because the singers from the Met come from around the world and you've conducted orchestras. So you have friends around the world. And so what is it like for you now to be living in the presence of death?
First, I have to say that, yes, I'm lucky to be in Montreal near my family. But, you know, even though when you count, maybe when we see those numbers, we can see, oh, some parts of the world are safer than others. What I'm feeling at the moment is much more being a citizen of the world. I think that we're not safe anywhere, really. I think we have to take it seriously everywhere. And there's no pride in, I think, wanting to show the world that maybe one part of the world is better than the other in dealing. I think we should all feel like we're the citizen of the earth here. Of course, even more in my case, I'm a citizen of Canada, but I'm also, you know, culturally a citizen of the United States. And for me, the colleagues I have in Philadelphia and in New York are as close to me as the colleagues in Montreal are. And I'm concerned and I'm worried, and you know, our audience members, I want to make sure that I do my best. And this is what I tried to do in the last few months, doing my best even without being there physically, because in a way, in confinement, it doesn't make, you know, such difference if you're somewhere physically or not, to connect, to reassure, to lead, to try to help. Music at the moment is still a moment for us to hope, but to reflect. And this Requiem is hopefully both. It's a reflection on the lives that passed and the families affected and still affected by it. In New York, I lost two colleagues during the pandemic to the COVID-19.
I'm so sorry.
The Met Opera. We lost one member of the viola section in the Met Orchestra, and we lost one assistant conductor who was one of our most wonderful colleagues in the music staff. So it became very real to see all this. And I think that it's important to do everything, you know, especially as artists, to bring music to the people who are struggling, to give them comfort, but also give them hope. And it's also for me important as a leader that I can be there for my institutions and also really be ready to bring the music back live when it's going to be possible. Of course, it's not possible at the moment, but we need to be ready when it's becoming possible. And so that is, of course, why, even though I'm in Montreal, I'd like to feel that in my heart, I'm everywhere at once.
Yeah, Nick, I love hearing you talk about music. Thank you so much for talking to us today. And I really wish you and everyone you love and everyone you make music with, I wish them well. And thank you so much for your music and your thoughts.
Well, Terry, it's a privilege always to talk to you. Really, thank you for your great questions. And I wish you the same
and
the whole team around you and your loved ones. And I can't wait to be back in Philadelphia and making music.
Yannick Nézet-Séguin, music director and conductor of New York's Metropolitan Opera and the Philadelphia Orchestra. Our thanks to the Philadelphia Orchestra and to Steve Kwasnik, Terry Murray, Adam Staniszewski, and others at WHYY for recording the interview we just heard. The Philadelphia Orchestra will launch its upcoming season with a digital broadcast on September 30th with selections of Rossini, Verdi, and Mozart. One of the biggest hits in country music right now is a song called Black Like Me by singer and songwriter Mickey Guyton. Its success is all the more notable because Guyton is a black woman at a time when there are few people of color scoring major country hits. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Guyton's new EP, called Bridges, opens up conversations about race and gender in the context of country music and America in general.
Hey God, it's me. I hate to be a bother, but I could use a minute or two. Yeah, I'm just so heartbroken, disappointed in the way this world is coming unglued. And I can't help but wonder, are you?
Mickey Guyton is a 37-year-old black woman who's been recording country music for over a decade and writing songs within the industry longer than that. But chances are you never heard of her until now because of a hit song she co-wrote called Black Like Me. She co-wrote it over a year ago, the title inspired by her reading of the 1961 book of the same name by John Howard Griffin. But Guyton didn't release it until May of this year when, moved by the murder of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter protests, she posted a version of the song on her Instagram account. It caught the attention of the streaming platform Spotify, which began promoting the song, which now has millions of streams.
Little kid in a small town, I did my best just to fit in. Broke my heart on the playground when they said I was different. Oh, now I'm all grown up and nothing has changed. Yeah, it's still the same. It's a hard life on easy street, just white painted picket fences far as you can see. If you think we live in the land of
In this song, Guyton begins singing in a near whisper. She's confiding in you, or perhaps talking to herself. Then it shifts into a billowing chorus that demonstrates her potency as a vocalist, with a voice that's easily as good as that of Nashville's current queen of bombast, Carrie Underwood. But the crucial part comes 2 minutes into the song, as Guyton reaches out beyond autobiography to something more universal. Or at least universal among black listeners, when she sings, "I'm not the only one who feels like I don't belong." Guyton is talking about the American black experience of feeling like a stranger in one's own land, which is a big idea. and she's also talking about the notion of belonging in country music. She's been made to feel, until now, not worthy of a place within the industry, which is a smaller, more specific idea, and one with enormous pain and power. It's in the way Guyton unites these two notions that gives Black Like Me its electrical charge.
Fences, far as you can see. And if you think we live in a land of the free, then you should try to be, oh, black like me. Oh, and someday we'll all be free, and I'm proud to be, oh, black like me. And I'm proud to be.
Mickey Guyton's new EP, Bridges, contains a half dozen songs. There's a lovely ballad called Heaven Down Here that I used at the start of this review, and a novelty tune called Rosé, a comical answer to country songs by men about drinking beer and whiskey. More seriously, there's What Are You Gonna Tell Her?, a message song to young women that reminds you that Guyton must always grapple with the double difficulty of race and gender.
She thinks life is fair, and God hears every prayer, and everyone gets there ever after. She thinks love is love, and if you work hard, that's enough. Skin's just skin, and it doesn't matter. And that her friend's older brother's gonna keep his hands to himself. And that somebody's gonna believe her when she tells. But what are you gonna tell her when she's wrong? Will you just try and say it's been that way all along? What are you gonna tell her when she figures out that all this time you built her up just so the world could let her down?
The very middle-of-the-road calmness of much of Guyton's music makes the racist denial of her entry into country music stardom until now all the more starkly obvious. If someone as assiduously by-the-book, commercially ambitious, and extravagantly talented as Guyton cannot make it in the modern Nashville, what black artist could? There have been a few major black country stars, such as Charlie Pride starting in the 1960s, and Darius Rucker and Kane Brown today. But there have also been scores of black country singers who've broken through only to be quickly cast aside. The industry may be paying attention to her now because of the cultural climate surrounding Black Like Me, but the issues Mickey Guyton is raising, in her songs and in the interviews she's giving, are ones that pose new challenges not just to country music, but to our country itself.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed Bridges, a new EP by Mickey Guyton. While Donald Trump is never shy about touting his wealth and business acumen, he's not so willing to disclose hard information about his finances, such as his tax returns. And unlike other presidents, he opted not to put his business interests in a blind trust upon taking office. Our guest today, Forbes magazine investigative journalist Dan Alexander, has pored over countless business records, mortgage documents, and government reports, and even staked out some Trump properties to assemble a fairly detailed picture of the president's business interests. He says Trump owns over 100 different business entities, and despite the skepticism of some critics, he is a billionaire. In his new book, Alexander also details dozens of examples of the president's business dealings that present potential conflicts with his responsibilities as a public official. Foreign nationals and governments, lobbyists and federal contractors pay millions in rent to Trump's commercial real estate holdings, to cite just one example. Dan Alexander is senior editor at Forbes. His book is White House Inc., How Donald Trump Turned the Presidency into a Business. He spoke to me from his apartment in Jersey City, New Jersey. Dan Alexander, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
You open this book by describing going to an office tower in San Francisco. And to get in, I think you had to rent one of those little working spaces on one of the floors just so you could get in the building. You wanted to check out a particular office space. What were you after?
So I had seen a document a few months before that I sort of stumbled across. And when I stumbled across it, I was pretty shocked. It was a list of all of the tenants in 555 California Street, which is sort of the synonymous building that not many people pay attention to, but actually is Donald Trump's most valuable holding in his entire portfolio. He only owns a 30% stake of the building, but because the building is so valuable, that 30% stake is worth over $400 million, even after debt. So I found this document that showed all the tenants in the building, which is a big secret of Donald Trump's business. You know, where is he actually getting his money? Who's paying him? And the answer is the tenants in his commercial real estate holdings, including this one. But it's hard to figure out who those tenants are. And so this document showed who all of the tenants were. And on the 43rd floor, the document showed Qatar Investment Authority. And when I saw it, I was really surprised because I'd never heard anything about it. And when I searched around online, I couldn't seem to find anything else about it. The Qatar Investment Authority, their website didn't list an office in 555 California Street. There didn't seem to be any record of it anywhere. And so I got curious, well, is this really true? And in order to figure that out, the only way to figure it out seemed to be to actually go to the building and to get inside and look at the office.
So when you got there, what did you find?
So I get there and it was, you know, this moment of the document that I wasn't sure if it was real or not coming to life. There it was, a beautiful office with Qatar Investment Authority written on the wall. The thing looked like it had been, you know, given a spectacular build out. But the really strange part was that no one was there. There was no one at the front desk where, you know, the receptionist would normally be. A lot of the interior walls were glass, and so you could kind of see through it. There was no one in any of the conference rooms. No one anywhere. Even all the furniture looked like nobody had ever sat in it. And so I knocked on the door, no one answered. And then I saw that on the front desk, there was a plant. I think it was an orchid or something. And it was totally brown. Looked like it had been dead for months. And so this seemed to be an office that somebody was renting and not actually using. And so then your brain starts connecting these pieces. This is the Qatar Investment Authority, which acts as an arm of the Qatari government, renting an empty office space in Donald Trump's most valuable holding. And here it is sitting in front of me and no one knows that this is going on.
Right. So you did some calculation. Trump owns a 30% stake in the building. And so roughly how much was the Qatari government paying for this office that they apparently weren't using?
It doesn't look like that much money. Assuming that they're paying market rates, then their full annual rent is about $450,000, which means that Trump's 30% cut of that, equivalent to his 30% ownership of the building, would work out to about $135,000. Not an amount of money that would matter to most billionaires, but Donald Trump is not like other billionaires.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I spent years covering billionaires from all over the world for the Forbes 400 and the Forbes Billionaires list. And a lot of these guys, you know, they don't care that much about small amounts of money. Frankly, they don't really care where Forbes puts them on the list. Donald Trump, more than anyone else, anyone that we've, and we said this before he was a political figure, cares about where he ranks in that list. And if you care that much about where you rank in that list, then you care that much about any little thing that you can do to get higher on that list. And if you look through, it's not just the Forbes list. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, back in the late 80s, Spy Magazine did this test where they tried to figure out who's the cheapest rich person in New York. And so they sent checks to all these different people. And, you know, the first check, I don't remember the exact amount, but let's say it was $1. And they said, who's going to cash this check? And, you know, maybe a dozen people cashed the check. Well, they repeated the exercise over and over again to figure out who was actually the cheapest. And I think that the final number was like, you know, 37 cents or something like that. And there were only two people on the starting list who cashed the check. One was a Saudi arms dealer, and the other one was Donald Trump. He's a guy who cares about small amounts of money, even though it doesn't make any logical sense.
So this office that appears not to be used, and you spoke to people around there, and no one had ever seen anyone actually working in there. Explain why this matters. What was happening with Qatar during Trump's presidency that might have given them an incentive to send some money Donald Trump's way?
Right. So, you know, Trump arrives in office, and unlike, say, you know, the George W. Bush presidency or the Barack Obama presidency, there doesn't seem to be coming in a really clear Middle East policy, you know, where he is going to do X or he's going to do Y. And so he's kind of a blank slate. And when he comes in, the very first trip that he takes is to Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis are U.S. allies, as is Qatar, but those allies are sort of fighting amongst themselves. And the Saudis are accusing the Qataris of funding terrorists. So Trump goes over to Saudi Arabia and he comes back convinced of this argument. And he says, you know, right away, well, you know, Qatar, and remember, he's speaking about a U.S. ally, you know, Qatar, unfortunately, has been a funder of terrorists historically. And everyone's kind of like, whoa, that's a pretty wild thing to say about a U.S. ally. And Trump sort of pitches it as, well, this is, you know, me doing business in an unconventional way. You know, somebody had to shake things up. And so Qatar, after that, you know, goes on this big lobbying spree where they're hiring a bunch of people in Washington. They're really trying to repair their image and make sure that the United States, one of their most important allies, isn't accusing them of funding terrorists. And around that time is when the Qataris move in to this, well, quote unquote, move in to this unoccupied office space in San Francisco, apparently figuring out a way to secretly funnel money into the president's business empire. And then the position that Trump takes on Qatar does a total 180. He invites the Emir of Qatar to the United States. And on the second one, he says, you know, I'm so proud of you for all of that you've done to fight against terrorism funding. And the Emir of Qatar is sitting there in the Oval Office, and he's like, well, I just want to make something clear, Mr. President. We were never supporting terrorist funding. And Trump just sort of nods along. And then you go about a year after that, the Emir of Qatar comes back to the United States. And this time, Trump rolls out the red carpet. They've got a huge dinner ready. Trump's invited a ton of business people there. There were like 40 business people in the audience, and a third of them were billionaires. This is, you know, a who's who of America meets a who's who of Qatar. And where do they host it? Of all places, in something called the cash room of the Treasury Department, which is where the United States used to store, you know, its currency, its gold, its silver, and that sort of stuff. And Secretary Mnuchin stands up and he says, you know, this room is a really fitting tribute to the economic and security partnership of the United States and Qatar. And then Trump stands up and he says, you know, I just want to let you know, addressing the Qataris, that here in the United States, we really appreciate your investments. And so it's hard to get inside someone's head, but if you add up all of that timeline, it certainly leaves the question of, is U.S. policy being informed in part by business deals that are going on the side that no one is aware of?
Right. And it's fair to note that the world is complicated. A lot of things can affect U.S. foreign policy. So you reached out to the White House, to the Trump Organization, to the other partners in the office building, to the government of Qatar. Did anybody offer you any explanation?
No. Reached out to all of them, and the answers were either ask somebody else or no response or decline to comment.
Now, you're right that when Trump occupied the White House, never before had someone assumed the presidency with such a large business reaching into so many areas, more than 100 different entities he owns, as you say. What does federal law provide for government officials who have business that could present potential conflicts?
So there are some disclosures that all officials have to make. You know, they have to list, for example, all of the companies that they own, and they have to give some information about either the revenues or the profits that those companies generate. And so we know what he owns, we know a little bit from that about how profitable these companies are, but you've got to go to a whole range of other documents to put together the full picture and understand really what his empire is, how much money it's generating. And then what they don't require, of course, is to show your tax returns. They also don't require you to say, for instance, who's putting money into those companies that you own. It's a very simple loophole that allows Donald Trump to basically follow the law without much disclosure about who's actually paying him, because all of the money flows through shell companies.
Now, federal law doesn't require a president to place his or her business interests in a blind trust. It's been a tradition that other presidents have followed. For Trump to have done that, given that he owns 100 different business entities, would he have to sell all that, basically, and put their value into something simple that he doesn't control, like, you know, index stock funds?
Yeah. If he were to truly have a blind trust, you can't have a blind trust and have a building that says Trump Tower on the outside of it. You know, how blind is that? Everyone can tell what you own, including yourself. So you would have to divest those assets, hand it over to a trustee, and then let that trustee invest in whatever they decided made the most sense based on what your financial goals were. So it could be an index fund, could be bonds, you know, but something that wasn't readily recognizable to everyone, including yourself.
But if you say, well, I'm going to keep all the businesses but let somebody else manage them, that doesn't really prevent conflict, right? Because you know, and contributors and favor seekers all know who's what your businesses are and how you might benefit them. So that really doesn't accomplish the same thing, right?
Well, that's right. And, you know, if you just think about it, I mean, how many business owners who are in their mid-70s are really on a very active day-to-day basis managing their businesses, especially ones that have other interests? Not that many. So what Trump has done, where he's basically handed over the keys to his kids, well, that's what anyone who was still in the business would probably be doing anyways. So there's really not a whole lot of separation there. And ultimately, the question is, who controls the money? And the person who controls the money, who owns the money, is the president.
And an issue that came up early in the Trump presidency was the fact that he was opening this, the Trump International Hotel in Washington. It occupies a building that's actually owned by the federal government, right, by the General Services Administration, the old post office building. And so the Trump Organization has a lease with the General Services Administration. And it actually has a provision that prevents any elected official from benefiting from the lease, right?
Yeah, that's right. And the provision seems pretty clear. You know, it says that no one shall be admitted to share any part of this lease or any benefit that may arise therefrom, provided, however, you know, it goes into, it's a bunch of legal language, but basically it's saying that if you're a public official, that you can't be on the lease. So when Trump becomes a public official, it seems pretty clear that he's not able to be on the lease. And then there's the other question of whether by owning this hotel, it opens him up to violate the Foreign Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which prohibits U.S. officials from collecting money from foreign governments. And those two things are immediate issues on day one of his presidency that the government has to consider how to handle. And ultimately, the GSA decides that he can, in fact, be a part of the lease. And part of their rationale there is that it's a shell company that owns the lease, not him personally. Well, of course it is. I mean, that's how business works. No one would hold a lease that's worth $200 million, you know, in their own personal name. But that was one thing. And then the other part was the Emoluments Clause. And with the Emoluments Clause, they basically didn't weigh in. You know, they said, we recognize that this could be an issue, but we have determined that we're not going to make a call on it. Basically, it's kind of above our pay grade. And then when they went back and did an investigation of this, then, you know, they said, well, sure, it's above your pay grade, but it's actually not above your pay grade. You know, it might feel that way, but your job is to make sure that you and everyone else is following the Constitution. That's the fundamental, you know, first law and job of everyone in the government. And so by not making sure that this was compliant with that, you abdicated your responsibilities.
You know, there are legal actions aimed at getting Trump's tax returns and other data from Deutsche Bank and other places. And these seem to have some momentum. What impact do you think they might have?
Well, I think that, you know, if you just look at what Trump's own lieutenants have said about his tax returns, you know, Michael Cohen, in sworn testimony before Congress, said that he believes that Trump does not want to release his tax returns because there are things that, you know, people will look at and that will cause him legal issues. And even Phil Ruffin, who's Donald Trump's best friend, partner on his project out in Las Vegas, a fellow billionaire. You know, I was with Ruffin in Las Vegas and I asked him this very question, you know, what do you think, why do you think he doesn't want to release his tax returns? And Ruffin said, well, you know, I wouldn't really want to release mine either. I mean, you know, if you release them, then you've got, you know, a bunch of people like you, you know, pointing at me, a bunch of people like you and other reporters and other people who are obsessed with taxes just pouring over the things looking for mistakes. And, you know, that, first of all, to anyone, that would be an uncomfortable thing. Nobody likes to be audited, certainly not to be audited by 5,000 people. But for the president, who, you know, has made some very aggressive tax moves in his past, that would be a very, very scary thing. And so, I think that if they do come out, that there are going to be real questions about whether Trump was paying his fair share in taxes.
Well, Dan Alexander, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Dan Alexander is a senior editor at Forbes. His book is White House Inc., How Donald Trump Turned the Presidency into a Business.